Good afternoon, everyone. Today is March 24th, 2015. This is the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. I'm calling this meeting to order. I apologize for running a few minutes late, but when the big co-chairs call, the rest of us listen. So we are going to be continuing our public hearing on House Bill 5040. I'm going to go ahead and open that that public hearing. And I'm sorry, Co-Chair Johnson, did you have something to share before we started the hearing? Or
I would just like to put it on the record that Senator Hansel has a conflict and asked to be marked as excused, please.
All right. Ms. DeBerka, do you have anything for us at this point?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, and members of the subcommittee. Today we will continue hearing from ODOT. There are two responses from questions that were asked yesterday about merchant fees for credit cards and about streetcar funding, and those responses are posted in OLIS under yesterday's meeting date.
All right. Thank you so very much. Mr. Garrett. Welcome back.
Good to see you, sir.
Thank you so much. And while you're getting organized up there for your benefit and for the committee, I might mention that it looks like on Thursday there's the possibility that we will shift to a different room so that we have a maximum amount of time before we adjourn, and the full Ways and Means meets in this room at 4 o'clock. So we're going to try and make sure that we don't have to break 15 minutes early so they can set up. So welcome back. Looks like we're going to be talking about DMV and the rail division today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be very quickly, as Ms. Nemberka has actually checked the box for me in terms of the responses. I will also tell you that the questions that Co-Chair Johnson broached yesterday during rail are embedded in Mr. Gard's presentation here. So we have those separate issues with regard to the streetcar subsidy, the investment made by the lottery-backed bonds, the merchant fee information that really is information provided by the Treasurer's Office, a fairly detailed articulation. We also pointed out three examples of motor carriers paying by credit card and the merchant fee impact associated with those transactions. And then finally, we shared the ODOT state service charges and assessments over the last three biennium to give you a walkthrough and a walk across of the activity, the puts and takes over the last several years. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would turn it over to Mr. McClellan to begin the conversation on DMV.
Thank you so much. Welcome, Mr. McClellan.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gumber, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan, for the record, DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation. I'm here to tell you about DMV and our budget request for the 2015-17 period. First off, the mission of DMV, as we've been able to discern it from statutes and feedback and guidance from the legislature, is to promote driver safety, protect financial ownership interests in vehicles, and to collect revenue for Oregon's transportation system. And we do this with convenient services responsive to our customer needs. Customer service is a big part of who we are as an organization. It's part of our DNA, I think, as an organization. We focus a lot of our energies around serving the public as best we can with the resources that we have. Strong work ethic within DMV to do that kind of high-quality service. As was mentioned yesterday, many people looked at us as the face or the voice of state government. Perhaps no other state agency has that much contact with the public and with businesses, nonprofits, and other government agencies than we do. And we take that responsibility very seriously with each person we have contact with. Is that importance of who we represent, more than just DMV and ODOT, but state government overall as we serve the public. Very significant responsibilities that we have. Over 3 million people have Oregon DMV customer numbers assigned to them. We have 3.2 million passenger vehicles and nearly a million other vehicles, commercial trucks and trailers, travel trailers, motorcycles, over 70 million electronic inquiries per year from law enforcement agencies through the law enforcement data system and state police, and nearly 3 million record requests from auto insurers, government agencies, and many other types of organizations. Very high volume. Our goals include being a diverse and inclusive employer, the goal there being reflective of the communities that we serve around the state. We have 60 offices in every corner of the state and in between, and we want to be as much like the people that we serve as possible so we can provide the best service we can. Another goal is to enable convenient and secure access to our products and services. And that's over the internet. That's in the location we choose for our offices. It's being as accessible as we possibly can to people. Another goal is to protect customer information, to guard against identity fraud. And that is increasingly a responsibility that we've picked up over the last few years, recognizing that a driver license, an ID card, represents more than just your ability to operate a vehicle safely. It is the identity credential of choice in our country today. And so much more focus on who the person is and ensuring that there isn't fraud being attempted as a person comes to a DMV office to obtain that photo ID or driver's license. We also use performance and service measures so that we're doing data-driven type decision making. We're tracking how we're doing on a daily basis and sometimes an hourly basis. And another goal we have is to invest in technology and to enhance our services and to achieve operational efficiencies. And I have more to share on that as we get further into my presentation. Our programs are quite varied. We support many different businesses and government agencies, and individuals depend upon DMV to provide good quality service. Those perspectives from our customers include transportation safety, consumer protection, transportation funding infrastructure, the identity documents, and traffic law enforcement, important roles that we play. We group our programs into six major areas, and I'll try to touch on each one of those fairly quickly. The first being, I think, an obvious one is driver licensing. That includes original, renewal, and replacement issuances of passenger, commercial, or CDL, and motorcycle endorsements. That's where most of the change in the last 6 or 7 years at DMV has taken place, in the driver licensing area of our organization. Today, we issue the driver license and ID cards centrally from a factory. You don't receive the actual card when you leave the field office. You receive a receipt, and it is mailed to you. That credential, that plastic, is mailed to you. And that's been in place for several years. We also do facial recognition.
Mr. Yes. Chair, just as a curiosity, where is that factory?
It's in Washington. You need more specific than that?
No. I'm just curious. Is that a request for proposals that resulted in it? Are they the only house that can produce that kind of document with all of its embedded security?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, the company that we use today, we were directed in 2005 by the legislature to use with doing the central issue and facial recognition. It was our existing vendor at the time. And the original contract was a procurement, open, competitive, but it was an interesting amendment to a bill that required us to use that same vendor. That vendor happened to have a factory in Washington, the closest one, as far as the location of where the cards would be produced.
I was here in 2005, and shame on me for not remembering, but I think that legislature specifying vendors is a rather unusual thing.
It was.
And is that in perpetuity?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, we actually are out right now of an RFP and close to selection of a vendor to take over that service, both the central issuance and the facial recognition.
Is the current vendor in the hunt?
Yes, they are.
Okay, so it's an open competitive bid. We didn't, when we forced you to do it 10 years ago, we didn't...
forever, no.
Make it forever.
Yes.
Just as a curiosity, Mr.
Please.
Chair, what's the scope of that contract? What are we talking about? Hundreds of thousands? Millions?
No.
Hundreds of millions?
It's millions. We pay by the card issued. It's just under $3 per card. So you look at the total numbers of cards issued, that's the value of the contract. Covers their costs of upfront, new equipment, and they recover that cost over time. So, and they refresh that equipment, cameras and other types of equipment that are part of that process. The facial recognition software that we use to look for identity fraud, all part of that contract, as well as the production of the cards themselves.
Okay, thank you.
Other changes that have taken place in driver licensing, legal presence was a very significant change. We require the person prove that they are in the country legally as a citizen or a legal immigrant. We do electronic verification of Social Security numbers and immigration documents, so we have more assurance of who the person is. We issue cards that expire when the person's immigration term in the United States expires. So most people get an 8-year card. If the person's papers expire in 2 years, they get a 2-year card, and they pay a slightly less fee to receive that. But that is also a fairly major change. Testing has changed a lot over time. Today, all the motorcycle testing, except for three-wheel vehicles, is done by a group called Team Oregon. They also do the training in the state, but they also do the testing. We accept a certificate from Team Oregon in lieu of another motorcycle test at DMV, and that was through legislation several years ago. In the last little over a year, 15 months, we've been accepting driver ed completion cards, certifying that the youth has completed driver education. We accept that in lieu of another test with us, that they've completed the training, they've completed a comparable test with the driver ed instructor, and we accept that as proof that the person can operate a vehicle safely. That's another fairly significant change. There's a lot more third-party testing of commercial drivers, and we are doing a pilot right now on Class C, regular passenger driving, with some driving schools to see if we could move even further in that direction to have the private sector do a little more of the testing in lieu of doing it in our offices. But a lot more internal controls and separation of duties around driver licensing, and that's back to that credential, that identity document, making sure that as much of the risk of fraud is being taken out of the process as we possibly can. So technology, business processes, those types of things. Second program I'd like to tell you about, I call it driving privilege control. It's a combination of things, but it includes suspensions, withdrawals, cancellations, revocations, and restrictions on driving privileges in Oregon. And those are initiated by the courts, other states, school districts, and DMV administrative action. For example, with DMV administrative actions, that might be a lack of proof of insurance. It might be a failure to submit an accident report, knowingly presenting a fraudulent document. Those are all things that would cause us to suspend a person's driving privileges. People then apply for those to reinstate those driving privileges after they've met certain requirements, completing a mandatory suspension period or after a court decision. The primary funding source for that activity is the reinstatement fee that a person pays at the end of that period of time. People may also relinquish driving privileges in exchange for a state-issued ID card. We don't charge for that. A person, frequently the elderly, will say, I don't feel safe driving anymore. They can give up that driver license and receive an ID card, so they can still use that as proof of who they are, and give up that driving privilege. And many seniors in particular are taking advantage of that as well. The third program, vehicle titling and registration, big, broad category. Titling is required for any vehicle, trailer, or camper owned by an Oregon resident that's operated on the public roads and highways in Oregon. It reflects ownership, it protects the security interests, and records information about the vehicle, make, model, odometer, brands that are on that vehicle. Out-of-state vehicles are required to go through a VIN inspection, and we check a national stolen vehicle database before we issue titles in Oregon. The title serves as prima facie evidence of ownership and is a prerequisite for vehicle registration. Registration is a means to identify vehicles. That plate that's put on the vehicle is an identifier. It's also used to collect revenues for Oregon's transportation system for both state and local government, and ensures compliance with other types of laws like liability insurance requirements and emissions standards that we have in four counties in the state. We have multiple types of registration plates. We have the standard tree plate. We have five different types of specialty plates, and I think it's 38 group plates today that are still being issued. And those are also set in statute, what's available. The group plates are used to raise funds for various organizations, nonprofits, higher education plate, things like that. Title and registration fees are our primary source of revenue.
Excuse me, Senator Johnson?
Yes.
Would you stop and go back to the specialty plates for just a second? We've got our basic tree plate, and then help me, I'm going to do this from memory. We've got cultural trust, wine,
Salmon.
Crater Lake.
Okay.
Pacific Wonderland.
Okay. Oh, that was the sesquicentennial.
Mm-hmm.
That's it, right?
Yes.
And for there to be another one, I was an advocate that Smokey Bear would get a plate. For there to be another one, does one of those five have to go away, or am I wrong in my thinking about that?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, my understanding is you would have to give, unless the statute changed. Originally, it was a maximum of three. Now it's up to five. So there have been exceptions granted in the statutes, and we're up to five today.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Do you have the records of how those plates are doing in terms of revenue?
Yes, we can provide that to you.
That would be very helpful because I'm just curious how they're performing. As we add more and more, obviously, the pie gets thinner and thinner, but I was just curious how they were performing.
Yeah, Chair Gomberg, we can definitely provide that. One observation is that the share of people, the percentage of people that choose a specialty plate hasn't changed much over time. And so as you add more plates, you tend to have less money for the other groups. You tend to rob from the others who choose to have that specialty plate. You don't add more people that choose a specialty plate. It's kind of been our experience over the years. Yes. We can definitely provide you the statistics on that.
Senator, if I'm not mistaken, House Transportation yesterday heard proposals for five new either group or specialty plates.
And Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Johnson, Amy Joyce actually provided answers to the questions you just broached, so it's easily provided, as Mr. McClellan said. So we'll walk through the puts and takes.
Would you also, Mr. Chair, would you also put on there what the terms and conditions are? As I recall, when we were trying to get Smokey a plate, Smokey was going to have to cough up $100,000.
Yes, we can provide what the costs
pretty
are.
Pretty steep slope for one little bear.
Yeah. Representative Whitsitt.
So I have a question. I was approached, and I have a special, one of my special bills by the Crater Lake Trust, who is the group that receives part of the money from the Crater Lake plates. They would like to increase the cost of their plates, as in it will bring more revenue into the Crater Lake Trust. And I was wondering if you could explain, for the record, how much money do they get from each plate, and if they were to increase the cost of it, is the entire additional cost, and these are plates that you choose, you know, mm-hmm. so it's not any sort of mandatory tax or anything, but they're asking for this. If they would get the total increase that they're asking for the Crater Lake Trust, the new increase in the price of the plates if the bill were to go through.
Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, if we're just changing the maximum statute as far as how much they can charge, right. It's going to be very minimal change, with some fee costs that we'd have to recover. The thing about these plates is that with the constitutional limitations on the highway fund, we must recoup our costs. We cannot charge the highway fund for that. So any costs associated with a change in plates or a new plate, we have to recoup those. And it's currently in the $80,000 to $85,000 range for a new plate, not quite $100,000, but it's in that neighborhood. And that's a steep climb for some organizations to get that kind of money right up front to cover those types of costs. On the Crater Lake situation, though, I think if the price is raised, most, if not all, of that increase would go to the organization.
That was my understanding, but I just wanted to make sure. When the groups ask for it, that it is money dedicated back into the group that has the plate then.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? All right. Please continue.
Chair Gomberg, the fourth program I wanted to touch on is fraud prevention. Our employee emphasis is on preventing and detecting DMV-related fraud. You know, every employee really has that responsibility. But it also includes fraud investigators in coordination with law enforcement officials. We're not a law enforcement agency, but we do coordinate with state, local, and federal officials on fraud, especially around facial recognition cases. As we detect someone who may be trying to pass themselves off as someone else, we pass those cases off to the Department of Justice to law enforcement for their further work. We conduct internal risk assessments. We investigate that suspected fraud. We have an emergency warning system where we notify other offices when someone may be attempting to pass bad checks, commit identity fraud, or pass counterfeit documents. That's an immediate electronic notice to another office. Watch out for this person. They're trying to pass something inappropriate to us. Driver license equals, like I said, identity document of choice. The integrity in Oregon is kept through employee training. We have detection tools, electronic verification, And again, that facial recognition capability to look at one photo and compare it against past photos of that individual and of all about 10 million photos we have in our database to see if that person may have applied and received a credential under a different name or maybe a different date of birth or something like that. Another form of fraud is title fraud. And examples of that include non-residents who are trying to title in Oregon. The fees may be lower in Oregon, especially since we do not have an ad valorem tax. California does. So especially a newer car is going to be cheaper if you can title that in Oregon. So residency becomes a very important thing for us to be checking for. Title washing is
Excuse me, Mr. McClellan.
Let me just stop you there because I have an anonymous constituent who calls me constantly or makes contact constantly. I have a border district, and Washington is just a bridge away. Who goes and checks on whether or not someone is using another state to perpetrate a fraud as far as where they're titled and licensed?
Representative Gumberg, Senator Johnson, it's frequently through residents, neighbors, who point those things out to us, and we'll work with Washington Department of Licensing to determine where is the person living and what type of plates should that person have, what registration should they have. We need tips, basically, for that type of thing.
So it's a complaint-driven system, and would one call the local DMV office or the local sheriff or the police department?
Probably could start with the local DMV, and we can have some further investigation to be done.
Cool. Thank you.
We do look at residence documents, but frankly, those are some of the easiest documents to produce as counterfeits. Leases and things like that or don't have security features on them. So,
do you go out and do a field investigation?
Rarely. Occasionally, but rarely.
So if I call up and say, Matthew Garrett doesn't live in this state and he's licensed here, so what?
Chair Gumberg, Senator Johnson, we would probably contact the Department of Licensing and they would arrange to have someone take a look. It's really up to them to follow through on. Is that Washington resident registered in Oregon inappropriately? I think the scenario you were describing.
Right, but I'm still trying to get to the end of the trail. Who shows up at whose front door and says this is bad and you're busted?
It's going to be a Washington licensing individual or law enforcement that would show up.
Okay.
And I just wanted to rewind a little bit because we were on a roll and I missed it. You were talking about fraudulent cases where people had requested more than one driver's license. Is that what I heard you say?
Yes.
Is that a prevalent issue?
Representative Gumberg, it was much more prevalent, I believe, before we had the facial recognition capabilities. Because we can now check to see if that new photo of you matches with the most recent photo we have of you, it prevents a lot of that fraud from taking place. Being able to overnight take the new photo from all of our field offices today, every photo that we've taken today will be checked against a database of, like I said, about 10 million photos to see if there's potentially a match where you have applied under a different name, perhaps. We're catching a lot more of that than we would have ever without that tool, without that capability.
And I don't want to take us too far afield, but does that mean those individuals with two licenses would get two voter registration forms?
I'm not sure. I would have to
fair answer.
Check into that.
And we may have to ask somebody else that question. All right, please continue.
Okay. I'm going to move on to the fifth program area. That's our business licensing and regulation. Approximately 2,000 vehicle dealers, both new and used vehicles in Oregon, dismantlers or wrecking yards, transporters, vehicle appraisers, commercial driving training schools and operators, and RV shows. These are all licensed by DMV for doing business in Oregon. Requirements include insurance and bonding, and most of those licenses are a three-year certificate. We have compliance specialists that inspect those new and used dealers. We investigate complaints.
I'm going to interrupt you just a second, Mr. McClellan. I think you're sneaking up on the microphone, and we're starting to get a little reverb there.
Oh, so too close. Sorry.
That's all right.
I'm leaning into it. Thank you. Those compliance specialists are ensuring compliance with DMV paperwork. Because those dealers are essentially agents of DMV. They're doing DMV paperwork. They're collecting fees, they're collecting the documents, and they're submitting those to us, making sure that they're following through on the timely submission of those that those papers and the fees. We also have an Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee, or ODAC. It's in statute, that provides industry input and it's a good sounding board for us about what we're doing and the rules that we have in place. They review proposed sanctions on their fellow dealers. So you have a group of business folks who are taking a look to see, well, if they did this and they did that and so many times, and here's this is the sanction that we're proposing to take against that particular business. They review that and provide feedback whether they think it's an appropriate sanction and the civil penalty that we end up assessing against them. The sixth and final program I'd like to cover is public records. We have both driver and vehicle records. Most of our records are considered public information, but there are laws that restrict the specific data in those records to those who are eligible to receive it. Oregon's records privacy law started in September of 1997, been around a long time. It's more restrictive than the national, the federal Driver Privacy Protection Act called DPPA. And examples of types of data we have and the restrictions that we have: Social Security numbers, only to qualified government agencies. The photographs that we keep, only to law enforcement agencies. These are examples of things that are very restricted, and I can go into others for you too, of in statute, who has access to different types of data that we are charged with keeping and protecting. We have electronic access to records. Those are subject to audits, spot checks, and inspections by our staff. There are approximately 1.1 million driver records are sold annually via the state's web portal. And that was through legislative direction many years ago that we make our driver records accessible electronically. And that is run through DAS and their contractor for the state portal.
Senator Johnson.
Let's talk about that for just a second. 1.1 million driving records are sold. To whom, for how much, and what fees are associated with those transactions?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, those are driver records. The fee that that is charged by the state through to seven companies that are considered disseminators, to only those seven who are charged with or are allowed to purchase and sell those records, we charge about $9.65 or something like that. It's just under $10 is what we charge for that record. The disseminator can add a fee to that, so it will depend on the market conditions, basically what they actually charge people for that. The largest user of that are insurance agents for rate setting, insurance companies that set the premiums for liability insurance. We also have trucking companies and other businesses that will order those records. And when I mentioned audits and spot checks, we're checking to make sure that the disseminators that are acquiring those records for us are only selling them to those who are eligible to receive it.
Okay, so you follow up?
Please.
You mentioned two, industry for rate setting, truckers for whatever purposes. What other kinds? Catalog companies? Who else would be qualified under the statute to acquire those records?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, I'd like to give you the whole list. I don't have it with me
okay.
right here.
Is that
something we can follow up with you
right.
on?
And then the next question is that $9.65 times a million mm-hmm. is serious money. Where does that go?
Different places. There are three components to that fee. $2 of it is our cost recovery, and that's set in rule that we have. $4.65 or 68 cents is what we charge to the Department of Administrative Services for the fair value of those records. So there's a charge that they have to pay. And then there's a $3 convenience fee or additional fee charged by DAS on top of that, which funds the state's portal services, e-government services for state agencies. So it's complex. There's three different pieces to it, though, in that total. And that's something also we can provide to you as more of a breakdown for you if you'd like to see that.
I would very much like to see that.
And I think one question that I wanted to add to that mix, being the recipient, I think, of probably 50 or 70 pieces of junk mail that resulted from my records being sold to somebody, who sets that $9.65 rate?
Chair Gomberg, there's two different parties to that. The Department of Transportation sets the $2 of amount and what we determine to be a fair value for those records. We make that determination. That gets you about the $6.60, 50 cents there.
So you could set that additional rate wherever you wanted to.
As long as as the Highway Fund Constitution requires that we recover our true costs, that we get a value for that asset. And so that's what we're determining, what that value is. That's how that fee has been determined. The other $3 is set by a citizen advisory panel that DAS utilizes to determine how much to add to that cost to fund the state's e-government program.
All right, thank you. Representative Whitson.
I'm not sure if Senator Johnson asked for this or not, but the total numbers sold each year, could you provide us with that? Since you have seven different agencies, I assume they all don't want the $1.1 million? That'd be almost $8 million
no,
a year.
Okay. Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, the seven disseminators buy a total of 1.1 million records per year, and that's fairly consistent over the last two or three years.
Okay.
If Mr. Chairman, if I may, just to complete the conversation, because there is the specific amounts articulated, whether it's the $2 or the $4.60 or the $3 that goes to the portal fee. Remember, when all these are sold, the money is directed to the Travel Information Council to run the rest areas that they have taken over for the Department of Transportation. So this was a business transaction that was conducted at legislative direction here. So remember, that funds about $10 million of a $13 million investment right now with regard to, I believe it's 28 rest areas across the state. So that just completes the equation, so to speak.
All right, thank you. So, Mr. McClellan, where do we go next?
Okay, Chair Gomberg, I'd like to go to performance measures with you. DMV has one key performance measure with the Department of Transportation, that is field office wait time. The current measure averages the office wait time over a 12-month period, average of averages of averages, basically. The large and the small offices are added together, and then we divide by the total number of offices. To us, it is not really a true measure of the customer's actual experience at DMV. And what we are proposing is a change in this KPM. We want it to be an average customer wait time. We have automated wait time systems in our field offices, and I think it's 37 of our 60 offices. Actually, you know, we pull a number when you walk in the door. It's tracking how long it takes between when you walked in and pulled that number until you're served by our employee. We would like to set, and we've been tracking this for a year now, track the percentage of customers served within a period of time. And our prior priority right now is to serve at least 70% of our customers within 20 minutes, within 20 minutes of walking in the door. A secondary measure that we are tracking would be that no one be served in more than 60 minutes. No one should have to wait more than an hour at a DMV office. Unfortunately, it does happen. And now we're tracking that. We didn't used to track that type of information. But by breaking it into, by the customer, focusing on how long they're waiting, it's helping us make some better decisions, I think, as far as the service to the public.
Senator Johnson.
I have done the performance measures long enough now to have noticed a pattern that when agencies aren't doing well, they want to change the measure. What are your current stats on the old measure?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, we have those in the materials. In fiscal year 13, it was at 16 minutes. Fiscal year 14 was 15 minutes, statewide average. And until the last few years, that was our target, was a 15-minute wait. We dropped it to 12 minutes a few years ago. I think 2 years ago, the legislature actually dropped it to an 11-minute statewide average. What happened, as you analyze that, you know, we didn't meet the target. We're serving more people. We have more transactions, partly because of the economy improving and more in-migration to Oregon. The complexity of what we do, we're checking more things. Each transaction takes a little longer than it used to. That causes more of a queue and a longer wait for people. So we had a kind of a confluence of greater volumes and more complexity and fewer staff. We administratively, we have eliminated 24 FTE, 11 within the field offices, over that period of time because of revenue issues within our agency, trying to right-size our organization to the, you know, the footprint of what we can actually afford in the long haul. So we've gotten smaller, volumes have increased, more people, longer wait times. That's kind of the equation that we have to deal with. The changes we're proposing are not because we're not meeting our target. The change, I think, is just because we want it to be more reflective of how the actual person is being treated. And when you're tracking the actual volumes and the people that the numbers that we have, you can actually get to what is the average Oregonian experiencing in a DMV office. If you take a large office that maybe has 700 people served in a day, in a small office that might serve 100 people, add those together and you get 800. One has 30-minute wait, one has a 10-minute wait. Shouldn't be an average of 20 minutes, especially if it's a larger office, it's the 30-minute wait time. That's the kind of waiting we want to have in this measure. So it's more at the person level, not as an average. You lose that actual experience. So that's my case, basically, to try to change the KPM around the wait time for us. Any questions on that? We have many strategies around customer service and field offices, and I'd like to take just a few minutes to talk about some of those. Several years ago, we went to an 8-year driver's license. It used to be 4. That cut the number of transactions we had in driver licenses, so fewer people means better service, basically, in a field office. 4-year registration for new vehicles instead of 2. Again, fewer transactions in our offices. Online registration came about 13 years ago. And you'll see in a minute about 20% of people choose to renew their registration online. That keeps people out of the offices. The driver ed certificates I mentioned a minute ago, third-party testing. We're trying to get people out of our offices to only be there when they need to do the transaction that requires an in-person visit. Within the offices themselves, we're doing things like lobby sweeps. We have reception people that meet people when they walk in the door, making sure that they have the right forms, answer their questions, ensuring they have cash or check if they need to. A couple things we've tried recently, a red carpet approach for a returning customer or someone who's just filled out a form. Go stand on the red carpet. We'll call you next. You don't have to wait in line for the next number to be called. A gold ticket is given to people on a knowledge test retake. You failed the first time around, we'll give you a gold ticket, come back, and we'll get you right in line to get on a testing machine sooner than you would otherwise. Photo taking, in some offices we're able to put seating closer to where the photos are taken. Just less walking time in the office. We can have people queuing up in the right, closer to where they need to be. Some offices are doing what we're calling multi-stacking, where we put multiple customers in line in a counter, 2-3 deep, so that as soon as the person is done, the next one can step right up and not be called and walk clear across the room. We do this in busier offices, first thing in the morning or in the busiest times, to try to move and be as efficient as we can to move people through quickly. Office reconfigurations, where we're able to do some remodeling, we've actually improved the customer flow. At times, we'll put our best people, the most specialized people, in certain places in the office so that we can have the highest volume production. I want to point out at this point, we also had a customer service task force that was formed in 2014. I think it was an 11-member group, studying the efficiency and customer service of our field offices. It included business, local government, and general public representation. We had 3 legislators sat on that group, Representative Gorsuch, Senator Thatcher, and Senator Edwards sat on that committee. When they finished, they had 11 recommendations. Their first recommendation was to replace our computer systems. They were essentially appalled at the age of the technologies that we're using today. They said accept credit and debit cards. You must accept credit and debit card payments. They recommended that we install self-service kiosks, that we use lobby queuing systems in the larger offices, that we post our current wait times online. We're very close to doing that, actually, and following through on that recommendation so that anyone can go to our website and see what is the current wait time at their local office. And those 37 that have the automatic wait time systems, you'll be able to check to see, you know, do I want to go wait for 10 minutes in this spot or 30 minutes in another spot? That will be available very, very soon. They recommended that we raise fees to cover computer and merchant costs, kind of across the board, to cover those types of costs. Increase our staffing in the larger offices. That's where they saw the longest wait times occurring. Scheduling appointments, putting placards at the counters to tell people why there's an empty counter there. Why isn't there someone standing there helping me? Well, they're out doing a drive test, or they're providing relief to another office. Put something up that helps explain why there's no one there when there's a long line of people waiting. They also recommended that we accept a receipt be allowed as proof of registration, and there is a bill actually introduced to do that this session. What we found is that many people renew very late in the cycle, like the day before their tags expire. And so they decide, I can't go online. I can't wait for that tag to be mailed to me. I'll go to my office. Well, if the receipt that they get for their online transaction could suffice as proof of registration, at least enough for the officer at the side of the road, perhaps they would not be cited. It does require a statutory change, but that was one of the recommendations from the committee to help get more people to renew their registration online. Another measure that we track is customer satisfaction. Every month we do 400 randomly, we contact 400 randomly selected field office customers. The survey measures employee helpfulness, courtesy, knowledge, and efficiency. Our goal is that 85% consider our service good or excellent, and we're consistently at or above that. You can see that from the charts in our materials. Another measure there is wait time satisfaction. Our goal there is 65% of good or excellent. That for many, many years, in 2009 to 2012, we were at or above 65%. The last 2 years we've actually dropped, and that's not surprising because our wait times have increased. So the satisfaction of wait times has actually dropped during that period of time. A few other measures, we track our online vehicle registration renewals. For years, that's grown consistently. Calendar year 2013, it plateaued at 20%, and we kind of gotten stuck at 20%. We're looking for ways that we can get more people to go online, use a credit card, and renew their registration. It's House Bill 2261, it's the one that had the receipt being considered. Another measure that we have is phone wait time. That's in our call centers. Our goal is a 45-second wait. That is tremendous. As I talk to my peers in other states, most are looking at 5-10 minute waits. And so when I talk about a 45-second wait, they're amazed by that. And that's the time it takes from when it's picked up until an agent actually talks to the person. Fiscal year 14 was 41 seconds, and that's on 1.7 million calls. So a very high volume. And finally, the last measure I was going to mention is title wait time. Our goal is 19 days to produce a title. Those are received through the mail and in our field offices. Fiscal year 14, that was 25 days, far above what we want it to be. And partly is a reduction in staffing, but also more titles coming in the door. So more vehicles being sold in Oregon, good news for the economy. People are going out to buy cars, but our transactions are much higher. So with fewer people and more transactions, it's taking us longer to complete that work. The introduction of a county registration fee creates more opportunity for the wrong fee to be submitted to us. And so it causes more special processing of titles, which also delays that turnaround time to produce a title. So more complexity has also been added to the process. Between calendar year 2010 and 2014, we saw a 17% increase in titles received. It's continuing to grow. We move quickly here to major budget drivers, environmental factors, and I'll just give you five examples of that. First and foremost is demographics. As the population grows, we have more people to serve. Ethnicity, language diversity, aging of our population. Our at-risk driver program is getting more people involved in that program, but it just makes more complex what we do. Our standards for eligibility have gotten tougher over time. And as new services are added, like new plates we were just mentioning, it does make it more difficult for our employees to do the right thing, to follow the laws and provide the services that people are requesting. Special services also add complexity. Expedited titles, like the county registration fee, recording odometers on older vehicles, offering veteran services to people. Those are all additional things that have been added to our plate over time that are in statute, required of us to do, but just it takes longer to do the core service that we do at DMV as a result of that. Our customer expectations are constantly evolving, and increasingly we see people want to be online, not in line, not waiting for service. They want it now. And it's not just the millennials that are asking for things now. Everybody wants it faster. They got a smartphone. They want to be able to do things very, very quickly and easily. We have a very old infrastructure at DMV, and computer systems are the primary thing I'm talking about there. We also lease a number of facilities around the state that are aging and are no longer meeting the needs of our customers, aren't large enough, parking isn't adequate, and just old facilities. Back to computer systems, many of our oldest systems are 60s, 70s, maybe 80s in nature, and this is very old technology. It keeps cranking along, keeps moving, it doesn't fail very often, but it's very slow to make change and costly to make change. And we see that in legislation frequently, where we do a fiscal analysis on a bill, and there's a DP impact as a part of that, because it takes so long to make the changes and do all the testing to make sure everything is still working as a result. And then finally, another major budget driver is federal mandates that we have, especially around commercial driver licensing. Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is constantly changing the regulations, new things that we have to do, changing programs and procedures that we have. I've got a list there of major changes over the past 10 years. I'm not going to really speak to those, but like I said, most of that is around the driver licensing areas. Things we've done to contain costs over time, we have eliminated positions through the right sizing of our organization. We are at 11-to-1 ratio for supervisors to employees. We've made our cuts mostly through attrition and reclasses of positions. We have several partnerships that help us be efficient. One is with the Department of Corrections. Approximately 125 offenders per month are receiving replacement or renewed driver licenses prior to their release. Department of Corrections makes sure that the inmate has the proper documentation. They're helping them get replacement social security numbers, birth certificates, filling out forms, and payments. Those are sent to us, and if we have a photo on file, we're able to issue a replacement driver license, or sometimes it's a renewed license, to that individual, and they can leave the institution with photo ID, and it helps them be successful at reentering into the community. It's a new program, really, for us to have in place. Another longstanding partnership we have is with Department of Environmental Quality. That's with the emissions stations. They're able to collect the registration at the same time that they're doing the testing. It's an excellent program we have. Today, diesel vehicles no longer receive, the owners of those no longer receive a notice that they have to go to DEQ. We've made that change in conjunction with DEQ in the last year. Definitely an improvement for people that we serve. And finally, an important partnership of the courts. We're working with the municipal and justice courts to receive traffic violations, the convictions, those abstracts, electronically, that they can send those to us. We'll have 3 pilot courts in place in about 2 months, and then we plan to roll that out to other justice and municipal courts as they are ready to do that. We have 2 budget packages.
I'm sorry, Representative Whitson?
I was wondering if you know approximately how much you have that is owed to you through traffic courts that hasn't been collected.
In fines?
Mm-hmm.
Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, I really do not know that. I'll see if we can get that information for you.
So if a fine is collected, does it go then to ODOT or a portion of it?
No, that does not go to us.
Okay, so
I'm not sure I would have any data actually on that.
What were you saying? Could you repeat what you said earlier about?
So today, more and more law enforcement are issuing electronic citations.
Right.
Okay, I don't know if you're aware of that, but they'll issue the citation. That information is sent electronically to the court, to the judge.
Okay.
Judge has that information, maybe has a laptop or an iPad, and they're trying the person. They're making a judgment about that case. And then today they print out an abstract. They print out that citation with their decision. It's mailed to DMV. We then hand enter that into our computer systems and then microfilm that piece of paper. What we want to get to is get that paper out of the whole mix so they can take that electronic citation make their decision electronically, and then send the conviction, which is now in the abstract, send that to us, and it record is added to our computer system, updates our computer system automatically, with some checks and edits, of course, and staff looking at it. But that'll take a lot of that paperwork out of the process, streamlines that whole traffic violation process.
Thank you.
Okay.
So we have two budget packages. First is package 140. It's a service transformation program, or STP. We have reduced the size of this request, but from what's in the governor's recommended budget, we're proposing 45 positions, about 30 FTE, and $30.4 million for the 2015-17 biennium. It's for our initial work on a program of manageable projects. It's a set of projects a consultant recommended we embark upon and take our time, take 9 or 10 years to make these changes. Don't try to do it, you know, too quickly. And that would be from the highway fund, like I said, about $90 million over that 9 to 10 year period. We're staying in close contact with the state CIO, Alex Pettit, and the Legislative Fiscal Office. We plan to follow their stage gate approach, the new quality assurance requirements, an advisory committee. We're going to do everything we possibly can to make sure we're as transparent as we can about how we're doing, both the good and the bad, and make adjustments as we need to over time. But we have to start replacing these old computer systems. With your support, we want to move forward. We've learned from our past experiences, and we're definitely learning from other states. Department of Revenue is another one. We're really modeling what we're doing after their appears to be successful work so far. And then those states that have been successful with motor vehicle agency computer systems. We want to start with our vehicle system. Install a point-of-sale system and a business licensing and regulation system, and start to improve upon our online capabilities. Something called DMV2U is really our idea there.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Just so I can follow this, you're asking for 30... I got a little confused in the number. This is $90 million from the Highway Fund for 30 positions?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, I'm sorry, I was confusing there. Over 9 to 10 years, we're looking at $90 million, so about $10 million per year. But our first request to get started is that $30 million figure and the 45 positions.
Okay, followed. And are the positions eligible? Have you made the correlation that they're eligible under the Highway Fund for all the activities that you want them to do? Has that been vetted legally?
Yes, Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, all the work on our computer systems would be eligible for Highway Fund use. It's part of the administration of DMV programs and services. It's a core function of what we do.
And so if this comes, where would the distribution come from the Highway Fund? Because the Highway Fund is divided among our colleagues at cities and counties. Is this out of ODOT's side, or do you expect to hit cities and counties with a portion of this from their 50-20-30?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, it's proposed to come out of the DMV fees, which is before the split to the local government and the remainder going to the Highway Fund.
So before the split. So in effect, then, you're diminishing their take.
Chair Gomberg, yes, that would be true.
And has that been negotiated with our partners, the cities and the counties, to their satisfaction?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, it's been discussed. I don't know if it's to their satisfaction yet, but we have been in discussions about that.
Well, I guess the reason that I'm thinking about it is that before the low carbon fuel standard blew up the transportation negotiations, there was a lot of emphasis on the relationship between cities and counties and the state in mm-hmm. our crumbling infrastructure. And I know how protective cities and counties were of their piece of it, and I'm just trying to figure out, rather than having the legislature impose this on our partners in delivering services to our shared constituents, where do we have the conversation about how the financing of this whole thing works? I don't think any of us will fight with you about the fact that your computers are a mess. Set aside the fact that you're sitting here announcing your computers are a mess and we've just given you 400,000 more registered voters. Leave that aside. I'd like to have the conversation about cities and counties and not making the legislature the instrumentality of disadvantaging cities and counties. It's like running around bayoneting the wounded.
Chair Gumberg, Senator Johnson, we did a cost and services study, looked at our fees about a year and a half ago, and one of the recommendations from that study was that we look at funding this through a general increase in our fees at DMV, both in the driver and the vehicle side of things. And the finding there, the recommendation was a across the board, pretty much $3 increase in our current fees would generate $9.5 to $10 million per year. Coincidentally, about what we would need for this particular investment in our computer systems. That's currently not proposed, and there's not a bill that I'm aware of that would raise our fees by $3, but that would be an alternative way to pay for this than what is currently in the governor's budget, if that helps.
It does. One other thing that I'm, follow up, Mr. Chair,
please,
that I'm curious about is this convenience fee remains somewhat of an enigma to me, the $4.68 across a million transactions, that you describe that as a cost associated with the putative value of the record. That seems to me to be a fairly arbitrary number, and I'm trying to figure out how that works out. Theoretically, could that be a source of funds?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, as Director Garrett just pointed out, the difference between the $2, which is our true cost recovery, and the $6.68 or whatever it is, $6.63 that we charge, that $4.63 is largely going to the Travel Information Council for rest area maintenance in Oregon. It's being drawn upon already, spoken for.
Do we have an account, follow-up?
Please.
Do we have an accounting from the Travel Information Council that is a pro forma on what those rest stops cost?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, Matthew Garrett, Director of ODOT. Yeah, I think we can sit down with our business partner. They can identify it and itemize out the amounts of monies that they spend per rest area here that will eventually culminate. And again, about a $13 million investment for the rest areas that they own and they operate and maintain across this state. So we can certainly work with them to provide that information.
I would respectfully ask that the committee get that.
Sure.
Good. And I guess I would just like to conclude this. I don't want to beat this to death, but I think that it is worthy of additional discussion. All of us represent cities and all of us represent counties, and I am just trying to close my eyes and picture the very warm reception that I'll get back home when I tell them that their proceeds out of the fund are being skimmed to buy the computer.
If I may, Mr. Chairman and Madam Co-Chair, this is a legitimate conversation. Now, again, we propose, and what you have before you is an investment strategy that takes it off the top, so to speak, before we start to allocate and distribute. And this money is distributed in that 60-24-16 percentage. This goes back to the old days. So 60% of it's taken from the state already, with 24 and 16 coming from the counties and the city. So it's not that 50-30-20 split we speak about these days. This goes back to the old formula here. But that said, this is one approach, but I think Mr. McClellan put on the table another way to finance opportunities, and I think it's incumbent upon us. If you don't accept the notion that there is a shared benefit, thus there should be a shared sacrifice, because there is benefit to local government, because we conduct business with them, as Tom indicated, whether it's through the jurisdiction themselves or their law enforcement agencies in terms of the information and back and forth. So it's that type of business transaction that I think, when all is said and done, you can speak about the big numbers here, but you're talking about 1% overall, about $4 million out of the $400 million we share with local government. So again, that's the premise, that it's a shared sacrifice. But if indeed we want to look at various funding scenarios, I think that's important. So as we navigate these waters, I think we should put on the table various funding scenarios here to see if there's a different way, whether it's a surcharge on top of the transaction, which helps pay for the improvements, and then once the improvements are done, that surcharge is removed. Those type of things. I think we're more than willing to have that discussion.
Good. I could just beat this to death. I think that that's important. I would rather do it with cities and counties than to cities and counties. And I think for some of us, there is a need for a deeper understanding. I have learned since this session started anecdotally, so I can't vouch for its veracity, that calls to check license plates, let's assume Betsy Johnson's pulled over in Scappoose, and the local police call in, that was going to be charged against OSP's budget. And I've got to figure out how that all works, because when you, Director Garrett, are talking about the shared value to cities and counties, if OSP is getting whacked for every inquiry into DMV's records, I'd like to know how that fits together. And I may have misheard it. It may have been misspoken. I don't know, but I sure am curious about how that would work.
I think, Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, it is, I'm not going to lay it on the table because I'll probably get it wrong, but you're exactly right. And we were actually the go-between, DMV. So we had to charge OSP for the transition, this transactions. This goes back to the use of the mainframe, to be very honest. This is data center conversations here. So it's a number of transactions. And what we have done is take us out of the middle of it. We don't need to be a facilitator for this conversation. There's an appropriate transaction between the Oregon State Police and law enforcement when they run that. That should be a known cost. That should be built into the budget. So right now it was an agreement between DMV and OSP on that transaction, and we would recover the cost here. Didn't make a whole lot of sense. So it really is a budgetary conversation that, for some reason, it either wasn't, by whatever means, budgeted into OSP's budget in terms of that transaction cost. So that is an issue that probably needs a heck of a lot more detail in terms of ensuring that the appropriate limitations are placed in the appropriate budgets. But the bottom line is my agency, specifically my DMV portfolio, needs to be out of the middle, because it was an awkward facilitation and translation between state data center transactions and money flowing through us that we had to charge back to OSP in terms of the number of call-ins, and that included the call-ins from local government, law enforcement agencies.
One more comment, Mr. Chair.
Please.
If we keep whacking OSP with more and more and more charges, pretty soon it won't matter, because there won't be any troopers calling in to ask for records, because we will have fired them.
Madam Chair, I'm right there with you. But again, there is a business to be conducted here, and I just think from a budgetary standpoint, it wasn't being acknowledged here. So right. It's a mechanical thing that needs to change.
Well, it raises a larger question, too, and this is something that Co-Chair Gomberg and I were just discussing with the two big co-chairs, and that is the lack of transparency in DAS's agency charges. And this has nothing to do with you. I'm just hoping that out there in agency land, DAS is listening to this, that because of the increased charges at the state, my old friend Scenic, we keep changing the names to protect the guilty, that if those charges continue to escalate, where's the breaking mechanism on all of that? And that's a rhetorical question out there for DAS. It's not for you guys. But I think we need to have a conversation with cities and counties to figure this out. And then last but not least, it still raises the question of how are you going to cope with those 400,000 additional voters when you already, by your own admission in several venues, have a broken system? That is not rhetorical.
That's what I was going to ask. Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, it's really the Secretary of State's Office and Elections Division that's going to be dealing with that additional set of individuals. We're going to pass information about our driver license recipients to them, and they're going to make those decisions about that. It's not adding transactions to us. If anything, it actually reduces some workload in our field offices if we're not asking every person if they want to register to vote. There's actually some savings to us in our offices.
Okay. Representative Whitsitt, did you have a question?
Yeah. I was wondering if you have an estimate of the percentage that to the cities and counties that they're looking at a reduction, what percentage reduction of the amount of money that they've been getting to meet this $90 million?
That's 16.24.
Well, I think over, Mr. Chairman, Representative Whitsitt, I think from what I understand, it's about a 1% reduction when we take it off the top. And again, the math I do here is we transfer about $400 million to our local government partners It's about 1% or about $4 million. We can certainly validate that, but that's my understanding right now.
Okay, just follow up. Some of the counties are using their road fund monies for law enforcement because they don't have law enforcement. And we've got a number of them in Southern Oregon. That is the source of providing for their jails, their deputies on the road. I mean, they are using this. I mean, the very concept that we are going to take some of it away from them could potentially mean no one on the roads in terms of law enforcement outside of OSP. And some counties, like the ones I represent, Klamath and Lake, are some of the largest counties in the state, lots of roads. No law enforcement, heavy drug problems, cartel problems. I mean, if we're actually looking at taking money away from the cities and counties, you need to look at what some of these cities and counties are being reduced to using some of their road funds for. I mean, we've passed it through the legislature here that they're allowed to do that. And so, I mean, I would highly recommend that you not do this, because the burden that you're going to put on your cities and counties will be tremendous. Maybe not in a place like Multnomah County, but certainly Klamath County, Lake County, Jackson County, Douglas County, Curry County, Josephine County, and so Polk County. Anyhow, I would have a really hard time agreeing to something like that. And I had another question. So on the computer costs, is it 45 full-time positions plus a computer hardware and software? I mean, are you talking about this money being an entire new system for DMV?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, it's software. There may be hardware associated, but it's really the software that we're trying to replace. And rather than do everything all at one time, we're going to do pieces at a time. I mentioned the vehicle system. That would be one of the first ones we would want to replace. That's actually where the revenues are coming, is title and registration money and the collection and the accounting for all that that revenue that we're taking in that supports cities and counties. It's the vehicle system.
Follow up. But didn't we took testimony earlier that the actual hardware system is like from the 1970s or something?
Chair Gomberg,
Cobalt or something like that from the 70s?
Cobalt is software.
Okay.
It's a programming language.
Okay. All right. And so is the hardware as old as the software, or?
No, it is not.
Okay. So that's all up to date. Why does software cost that much? Do you have to develop it, or does somebody have it that you purchase from somewhere?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, the amounts that we've put into the budget request are based on the experiences of other states where they've replaced large systems like a vehicle system. So where a commercial off-the-shelf system is available, we'll certainly be looking at that first as the first option, and to minimize the amount of original development that's required for what we need here in Oregon. But the estimates that we put into the budget were based on other states' experiences in buying the packages and the services that go along, those consulting services that go along with installing that new software and implementing it in the different jurisdictions.
Okay,
one last question.
So can you compare the numbers of individuals that you would be servicing compared to Cover Oregon, for example?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, I couldn't do that off the top of my head. We'd have to go back and take a look to see how it would compare. The numbers served is what you're asking.
Right. How many people do you serve each year through your office?
It's about 12,000 per day in the offices. I don't know what the total is overall. But, could do some quick math, I guess, on that.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Whitsitt, and I'd be remiss if I didn't come back to your... We can certainly find the transaction totals. And again, they're in the millions, and we can add those up for you. And you can compare them to any other opportunities out there. But I'd be remiss if I didn't address the earlier point with regard to the challenges that our city and county brethren face. I understand that. That's not lost on us. But again, you articulate it as a take, and I can certainly understand that. I don't agree with it, because I think there is a benefit from this investment that accrues to our city and county brethren. But as we shared, there are many opportunities to look at ways to fund this, and we should explore all those. And that includes growing the pie, because that really was the first premise here. We come to the table, we have needs, let's grow the pie. This can be embedded in a transportation funding conversation. So while I know that may be challenging, given where we are right now, that is certainly a hope and a scenario that I want to put on the table and explore, because I do believe it is a pathway that allows us to make investments that will benefit Oregonians and the businesses throughout the state of Oregonia with this this computer upgrade system at the driver motor vehicle services.
Our total budget for ODOT, what you are coming to us and asking us for, is how many billion dollars?
We're about $3.5 billion total, right, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Nierman, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. Thanks. So I appreciate the tour that I had of your field office out there the other day. One of the things that I think I hate to suggest like, if you do this computer system upgrade, you're going to get these great efficiencies, there's going to be these great savings or something. I would never want to be the architect of a speech like that, because I've seen so many of those speeches go down in flames. But I think in your case, I think you really do, just because of the sheer age of your system and just the fact that I don't think that the work that your computer systems do is all that complex. I think there is some real room for some low-hanging fruit. Almost any time you see a piece of paper in your office, that, mm-hmm. that's an opportunity mm-hmm. to make some great gains. When I was there on touring your office there, you had talked about that some of these gains were going to pay off in, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but better service to customers, kind of thing like that. And I'm wondering, maybe so if I can get a question out of this, is what percentage of the, if there are gains to be made by loss of paper and loss of microfilm, what percentage of those are going to go into better customer service, and what percentage of those would go into, I would like to see if there's sufficient discipline in the agency, just causing those gains to go into paying for the next round, or partially paying for the next round of the computer upgrade process there. So if you could, and I know you probably don't have this on paper, but just talk to me about the split on that, customer service or having the software pay for itself.
Chair Gomberg, Representative Nierman, I really cannot answer that question with much confidence right now. I think most of it will be an improved service. I think our turnaround times, our wait times, I think that's where we'll see the greatest benefit for the investment in the elimination of paper.
Yeah. I mean,
it's so much easier for the customer. It's so much faster for us to complete the transactions. It's going to change our business significantly in the jobs of our employees. Where today we have data entry operators, we maybe have people who are doing more checks and balance, you know, analysis, and maybe higher level people. That with higher skills you're going to need to be able to utilize those new tools. So I'm really cautious about assuming there's going to be a lot of ultimate savings as a result of it. I think the primary benefit will be in improved service.
Thanks. Can I follow one last follow?
Please.
That wasn't really the right answer to the question. I think that there's at least in your field office, and I bet it's worse at your central office, which I have an appointment scheduled to go to. But in your field office, you had, and I forget if it was two or three FTEs in a room that spent over half a day sorting papers, and that is something that's going to go away. So. I'll put this in as a question to you. You're not seriously suggesting that those two or three FTEs are going to go out into the front and work the counter or anything like that, are you? I mean, that would seem to me to be overkill. Maybe half or one FTE goes out mm-hmm. to the counter, and the other two get their salaries turned into the next round of software. I mean, that's the right answer there, but yeah. You can give me the actual answer.
Well, Chair Gomberg, Representative Nierman, that is right, and we've proven that over the years that we're going to manage our positions and look for savings administratively wherever we possibly can. Mm-hmm. We're not going to spend where we don't need to spend. I think a case could be made that we're understaffed in our field offices right now. As mm-hmm. you look at our wait times, if we could free up more time to have someone standing there serving the public, more people would get through the offices faster. But I do suspect there will be savings, and we'll be able to bank some of that savings as we move along. I don't want to build this program on the basis of headcount right now as far as being saved as a result of it. I think there will be efficiencies, and you're clearly seeing that in your visits of our facilities.
So I'll just ask that you keep an open mind that there are savings and that can go back into the next round of software.
Right. Well, Mr. Garrett, Mr. McClellan, I think we've got about 6 or 7 minutes left on our schedule. We were originally also scheduled to hear the rail division today. I think that train has left the station. but I want to make sure, Mr. Garrett, that you get a chance to finish your presentation. I had a couple of questions, but I'll hold those till you get things wrapped up.
So, Chair Gomberg, just quickly, the second package we have is a credit and debit card collection, merchant fees associated, the costs of processing those payments. That is a package you have there. We've assumed that 70% of the transactions we do in a field office will be done with a credit and debit card if people have that choice. We're not planning to take away cash or check, so you still would have that option. We think when presented with the option, 70% would do that. We've assumed 2% of the transaction volume would be in those merchant fees. And I think you're getting some information from the state treasurer as far as whether that 2% is a good number for planning and budgeting purposes. We hear that is a good number for us to use. We're assuming that it's a cost of doing business. And it's an expenditure. It's treated as an expenditure, not a reduction of revenue. It's something we have to pay. So we need that expenditure authority from you in our budget to cover that cost. There are other alternatives. A general fee increase at DMV could be utilized to offset that. Could be a service fee assessed. Could be a flat amount. It could be a percent of the transaction. Our preference would be a flat amount just because of ease of administration. And I don't want our employees trying to figure out on the fly what 2% of whatever the number is, because people are going to ask, how much are you going to charge me if I give you a credit card? And the other alternative is what we've proposed is from the highway fund. It'd be cost of doing business that's added to our budget. Our approach to the credit and debit card is by this fall, October, pilot in a couple offices, assuming it works well, roll it out to all 60 offices by June of next year. Just take our time, make sure it's working properly and all the security that we need. I will note, I think what we're going to need next biennium is less than the $6.3 million that's in our package. We had hoped when we first submitted this that all 60 offices would be up and running and ready to go by July 1st of this year. That's not the case. So as it rolls out, it's going to be a lesser amount that we need for next biennium. We have one piece of legislation that we submitted. It's House Bill 2465. It's a driver license issuance efficiency bill. It doesn't save a lot, but it eliminates some transactions that we do today and steps that we do in the process, like moped-only restrictions, not doing motorcycle skills testing for people from other states that already have a motorcycle. Why do that extra testing? Those types of kind of common sense things that we think need to be taken out of our statute we're required for. DMV is very complex, and just in summary, we do things as efficiently as we possibly can. And like I said, focus on customer service the best we can and utilize those resources. This budget request gets at infrastructure and service to the public. We hope you support that.
Senator.
Mr. McClellan, have you given any thought in the bill that you just referenced could perhaps be a mechanism? I don't know the relating clause. I don't know a lot of things about it. But I get called frequently by constituents who have held a driver's license in the state of Oregon for 40 years or more. I'm in that class. At what point does that sort of honored driver status have any cachet so that you could use your license that had been continuously issued, in my case, since the 60s, and say, I've been in your records this long, you have all my data, and I would, in effect, be grandfathered having held a license for X number of years, continuously.
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, great concept. The standards for issuance have changed, as I noticed earlier. Having a license for 40 years does not provide proof that you're in the country legally, necessarily, for example. We have that standard. So that's why we require the people bring birth certificates and immigration documents into our offices, even though they may have lived here many, many years.
But I understand some of this is federal imposed on us. Some of it is rural. The other fight that you and I have had previously was whether or not you take a DD-214. It seems to me that if someone has worn the uniform of this country in our armed services, that accepting that discharge document had certain merit. We give a lot of lip service to being nice to veterans, and to reject their DD-214 as an official piece of identification just stunned me when I found out that that was your policy. I just don't know at what forum you could have a conversation about the risk-reward of a continuously licensed driver for 50 years and a veteran. What's the risk? And frankly, if someone who was from the Philippines but had served in our armed forces, I'm almost willing to give them a pass. They've earned it. I just don't know. Is there a forum where that is discussed, or is that all internal DMV consideration?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, statutory permission would be helpful in some of those cases. With limited discretion that we do have, we try to apply it to the situation. There are a lot of people that cannot provide the documents that we've specified, and so we have some discretion around.
And you've been very helpful. I've come to you on several occasions, and you guys have been outstandingly helpful. But when I think of the amount of time that we waste doing these one-off cases, if there was a way to give you a little tiny bit more leeway in what I consider common sense situations, that might be valuable.
Representative Wetzel, if you could hold for a minute, I sense that that Mr. McClellan is very close to being finished.
I am finished.
You are finished.
Consider me done.
All right. You know, your very last comments really zeroed in on the questions that I had been holding for you. And that was my understanding, that you're looking to expand credit card acceptance in our field offices.
Yes.
And you're already doing that with people that make their changes online. And you're looking at about $6 million in expenses for transaction fees to do that in the coming years. I guess my question at this point would be more for Mr. Garrett. Sir, yesterday we heard about your motor carrier division and the expenses that they were running, and transaction fees of about $2 million. And what we have is essentially people that are in a commercial atmosphere who are making very large charges that we have been accepting credit cards for, versus generally the public who are making relatively small charges, and your field office is having to handle a lot of cash as a consequence of that, and yet we're just beginning to catch up on that. Is there a necessity to continue accepting cards for those commercial expenses while we're looking at increasing costs for offering that benefit to the public?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I believe it is the way business conducts business, and I think to take away that tool would be folly. And I think we need to catch up, and we need to look at ways to ensure that those individual transactions, now not a corporate transaction or company transaction, but the individual transaction has as many options before them as well, because I believe that's what Oregonians want. There is a cost to that. We need to articulate and vet all approaches to how we fund that, whether it's out of the hide of the Department of Transportation, or again, whether it is a cost of doing business, much like if you purchase gas in some places with a credit card, you'll pay a little bit more than what you would pay if you paid with cash here. I think it's a known way of doing business in other disciplines. I think that application could apply itself to conducting business with the Department of Transportation, DMV specifically.
Well, I do appreciate that perspective sincerely. I was briefly looking at some of the information you provided from yesterday. I noticed with interest the largest transaction that we conducted last year with the Motor Carrier Division, a charge of $1,999,510. Awful lot of frequent flyer miles racked up in that transaction. Our expense to do that, $39,000. I found that very interesting. I appreciate your perspective that it's a cost of doing business, but looks like we're going to be looking at about another $6 million to expand those opportunities in our field offices. Colleagues, other questions? Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
I just wanted to concur with Senator Johnson. I've been in this building 11 years, chief of staff for my husband until the last 2 years. And the single largest problem that we have had to deal with over those 11 years are our veterans who are older, typically unable to get driver's licenses because they, even though they've had a continuous license and lived in this state, don't have the appropriate, part of them because they're older, birth certificates or whatever. I mean, we had a case from Christmas Valley. A man went to Bend 5 times. Each time he would show up, they would tell him something else at the DMV office. He'd go home, and I mean, this is not okay. But I will say Paloma Sparks was a lot of help to us. I know she's with Boley now, but we worked our way through it. But the man hours spent trying to help these veterans who have continuously had licenses in this state was just incredible, and for the staff in our offices as well. So I concur with Senator Johnson. It's a terrible problem that we have. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Garrett, anything you want to share with us in closing?
I think we're good, Mr. Chairman.
All right. I'm going to go ahead, and if there's no further questions, I'll conclude the hearing for today on 5040. Colleagues, on Thursday, we'll be meeting in hearing room 170. And if there's nothing else, I'll go ahead and conclude today's meeting. Thank you all.